It's a short week, but not a quiet one for news, and news is what we talk about on This Week in the CLE, the Cleveland.com podcast discussion by the people who bring you your news, the reporters and editors at Cleveland.com. I'm Chris Quinn, editor at Cleveland.com, and I'm with columnist Mark Namek and reporters Courtney Astolfi, Evan McDonald, and Mary Kilpatrick. Welcome back to the podcast, guys. Missing the point of our first story seems to be a hazard in discussions about it. That story is the ban on plastic bags voted into law by the Cuyahoga County Council this week. Every time this discussion comes up, seemingly, people get twisted up in the energy and water it takes to make disposable bags versus paper or multiple-use bags. But a big part of this issue is actually about our waterways in Lake Erie. Plastic bags are fouling them and harming the fish. Courtney, let's start with the specifics. What does this legislation do and when would it take effect?
This legislation got tweaked. It's no longer going to take effect in October now. It's going to start January 1st of 2020, and it'll ban what they're calling single-use plastic bags, the ones we all are familiar with from stores. There are exceptions for different things like bags for pet waste, for carry-out food, a handful of different exceptions. But really, this does what similar laws in California and New York have set out to do.
So what are the penalties for stores that violate it?
The consumer affairs portion of Cuyahoga County is going to be enforcing that. There's escalating fees over time. I think on the third offense, it's up to $500. So there's not going to be really, I don't think, enforcement efforts where they're going out and looking for violations. It's going to be more of a passive when they get complaints. If they're in the stores for other reasons, they may find a violation if stores are still using them.
We'll get to some roadblocks to this in a minute. But what generally was their discussion about the need for this? What are they trying to do?
The discussion is hugely on the number 320 million plastic bags are used by Cuyahoga County residents every year. Was thrown out quite often in the discussion. The goal, particularly from Councilwoman Sunny Simon, who's been a main driver of this, is the effect on Lake Erie. Plastic bags get in the waterways, get out into the lake, they break down from the sun, and it puts out chemicals into our water supply. When it passed this week, she really talked about Cleveland's legacy and how the river fires gave birth to the EPA. She was just talking about how Cuyahoga has a responsibility to nature.
To do something. Mary and Mark, you both have done reading about this and about the arguments that are kind of counterintuitive that getting rid of the plastic bags works against some of the environmental concerns. What have you been reading?
So there's this one study out of the UK in 2011 that showed, and I believe that this is correct, but one plastic bag a paper bag would have to be used three times to negate its effect on the environment that the same plastic bag would use. So it's questionable whether or not paper bags are better than plastic bags. Reusable bags, I think it's a much higher percentage. They would have to be used like several times in order for them to be negated, negate the plastic bag.
But you're back to the energy and resources needed to make them. Does what's happening in the river and especially the lake, does that make it a worthwhile investment to spend the extra money to on paper bags and other alternatives just to save the waterways?
Well, Cuyahoga County decided that it was worth it. I talked to Jeff Heinen, the owner of Heinen's. He is disappointed with County Council's decision to ban plastic bags, not because he thinks plastic isn't a problem, but he believes that this isn't the right solution. A couple of years ago, he was in favor of a fee both on paper and plastic bags at stores. That ultimately didn't go forward. He said that moving exclusively to paper bags is going to cost Heinen's $2 million extra annually, which is, you know, real money.
Does that cost Heinen's $2 million or does it cost their customers $2 million extra dollars? I imagine they'll be passing that along.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay. The opioid crisis continues in Ohio and the region, and we saw a chilling headline on an Evan McDonald story about the number of overdose deaths during the Memorial Day weekend. Evan, how many people died, and is there a new drug mix that's causing this?
Over Memorial Day weekend itself, they think at least 8 people died, but in 8 days from May 20th to the 27th, it could be as many as 18. So they're largely attributing this to the fact that cocaine is increasingly being seen mixed with fentanyl, and a lot of people don't know that their cocaine is going to be laced with fentanyl, which is a much more powerful, potent drug, and that is causing these overdose deaths.
Why would the drug dealers mix that into cocaine, risking the death of their customers and not give them a warning? Or is it more that the people buying the cocaine know there's some fentanyl in it, they just don't realize how much?
No, it's the former. Typically, a lot of people kind of differ on this topic, but the most common refrain that I always hear on this is that they're trying to increase their customer base in heroin and fentanyl by putting this in drugs like cocaine and creating a cross customer base.
Because it's so much more addictive. Once you start to use this, you're more likely to crave it and want more.
Yes.
You attended a talk this week by the U.S. Surgeon General and doctors at the Cleveland Clinic that focused on this crisis. It was ended up being a very timely talk given the deaths. What did you take away from that?
It was kind of a quick visit but at that particular event. So the main thing that he touched on related to the opioid crisis was naloxone. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, one of his big issues during his time in the Trump administration has been getting a Surgeon General's advisory about naloxone, which is a opioid overdose reversal drug. When someone is experiencing an overdose, you can use this nasal spray to reverse the effects of that and potentially save their life. So he has been big on pushing that and teaching people how to use it. And there's been some evidence that it's helped a lot of people here in Cuyahoga County.
Yeah, pretty much. I think everybody on this podcast has dealt with the opioid crisis at some point during the last 6 years. We started covering this at Cleveland.com when naloxone really wasn't available and the effort was being made to make it available. We've seen countless deaths since. But naloxone deals with the backside after somebody's already overdosed. The county and others jumped on the news of the latest crisis this week to push a method by which you can stop the overdose with test strips, very easy test strips to use that determine fentanyl. But there's a problem in getting those into people's hands. What is the difficulty there?
A lot of people, these are still fairly new. Naloxone and Narcan, the brand name of it, have been pretty readily available for several years at this point, and a lot of people are aware of them. But the fentanyl test strips are still sort of new. So they've been available at several locations in Cleveland in particular, Circle Health Services on Euclid Ave and Care Alliance Clinic on Central Ave. And officials are pushing these test strips as a way to detect if your drugs are being mixed with more powerful drugs like fentanyl.
Mark, you've ridden around on occasion with the needle exchange folks who I think were the first to start distributing these strips. Are the drug users hesitant to reach out for these because they're worried they'll be marked as drug users and police will come after them?
A year ago, April of 2018, I traveled with the Circle Health van, which is formerly the free clinic, and that the team of guys have been doing this for 20 years. They had just gotten a grant from the Drug Addiction Board, Adams Board, to distribute these. The challenge they have, and I've watched their exchanges with the users, you know, this, they know this is not going to deter them. What they're trying to do is if they test positive, do a smaller shot, try a starter. But what they were trying to do was gather data on how much out there is tainted with fentanyl. So they were asking the needle exchange customers to come back and report what they found in their in their usage. And part of that is just to get a feel, and they all have to operate on the presumption that the drugs are tainted with fentanyl. That is one of the things that the health workers were preaching, like, just assume this. You really need to swab that spoon before you pull, meaning fill your needle.
Do the test strips give you an idea to the degree, or is it
no? The presence of fentanyl is available. Again, this isn't going to likely stop someone from using. The idea was to throw up a caution.
Evan.
And there's other issues surrounding this as well. One of the things that the test strips need is for the drug to be mixed with water, which would ruin the drug for the user. So officials really need to convince them to do this,
to waste a part
to
of
waste
their sample.
A part of what they just bought. But I was told by the Adams board earlier this year that they're actually trying to get these into more places. The efforts are still in the early stages, but they're looking at getting them into public restrooms, bus stops.
But if Mark is right that there should be a presumption that all drugs are tainted, what's the point? I mean, if I walk out and figure any cocaine I get, anything I get is tainted with fentanyl and I can't tell how much, how's that going to change it? If I'm addicted, I'm going to use the drug anyway. And if it's heavily weighted with fentanyl.
The health workers really were encouraging you to just go with a slower, you know, a smaller shot, do a test, see how you handle it. They know people are going to take them, but they, you know, they have kind of their lingo was, you know, just if it's positive, you're going to have to slow down. I mean, that's basically what their message is. And you know, go know that now this thing is tainted and be ready.
It's interesting because we had been on a decline of deaths and the crisis seemed to be abating a bit. People were still dying, but this has rocketed right back into attention.
Yeah, heading into this year, the numbers were encouraging. Last year, about 550 people died in Cuyahoga County of drug overdoses, which is a huge number, but the year before, in 2017, 727
right.
people had died.
Right.
But this year, the most recent numbers that the medical examiner released, they're expecting about 650 this year.
Oh, so it's a big increase.
So it's going back up again. And a lot of that looks like it has to do with cocaine possibly being mixed with drugs like fentanyl. Because last year, they only had about 250 cocaine deaths. And this year, they're on track for almost 340.
Wow. All right. It's been a busy week in county government, which Courtney covers. Let's start with a piece of news that broke on the eve of the holiday weekend, the announced retirement of Sheriff Cliff Pinckney. Courtney, that announcement answered a question we'd been asking repeatedly since the U.S. Marshals Service released the devastating report about the jail last year, which was how long does Pinckney survive in this job? Now we know. His last day is August 2nd. Will a new sheriff be in place by then?
We'll have to see. I know that there are questions about filling personnel gaps throughout the county. I think that the jail and the sheriff's office would be a pretty difficult job to fill, but they did fill the jail administrator job, so I'm sure they'll be pursuing it.
Do you think they would go back to somebody from the past? I mean, you know, you wonder, would Bob Reed come back? He had a blemish-free time as sheriff before Armin Budish came in. The jail was pretty much without problem back then. Is there any chance they would try and recruit him, at least temporarily?
I mean, we'll have to see. They've thrown out names of past sheriffs. There's been a lot of discussion looking back at how well, essentially, they ran things compared to what's going on now. So I wouldn't be surprised if folks wanted to look back at sheriffs who have gotten us through in previous times.
Were there any heir apparents in the sheriff's department that would be like the natural choice for this? Not really.
To me, not particularly, no.
This means that the two people in line overseeing the jail will both be new because we have the new jail administrator you mentioned. When does she begin?
She'll be starting June 3rd.
So the new sheriff will not have had any say in the person that'll be running the jail, but will be responsible for that person.
Correct.
All right, fewer and fewer people use cash anymore to pay for anything, and it appears Cuyahoga County has forgotten the precautions that are needed to ensure that cash does not disappear when people tender it for things like taxes and dog licenses. A new report by the County Inspector General found some problems. Courtney, what's the story here?
Yeah, so in the treasurer's office related to tax lien payments, just kind of poor, sloppy cash handling practices. $2,000 is still missing. More money was missing for a period and has since been recovered. But what strikes me as most noteworthy in this whole discussion is the auditors, or the internal auditor's office has for several years pointed out problems with that particular office's cash handling. They have said that they've implemented some changes, but
well, it got so bad they stopped taking cash for a while,
right,
until some other officials found out. Mary?
Is there any indication of foul play, or is this just mismanagement?
We don't really have answers on that $2,000, but we don't know because the practices were not.
But this is an office that long has been called the treasurer's office. I mean, it's kind of staggering to think that that office would forget basic rules of cash handling.
It is, and I think it's concerned folks in years past, not necessarily most recently, but when they weren't as quick as perhaps some people would have preferred in getting their protocols a little bit tighter. And
is there any word from Armin Budish, the county executive, on this? Has he offered any statement on how this could be happening or how he intends to fix it?
I haven't.
Nothing. Kind of silent. All right. Well, talk about a pile of cash. Courtney also reported this week the county is looking for ways to provide $40 million for basic maintenance of Rocket Loans Arena, formerly known as the Q, formerly known as Gund Arena. This isn't the same as the money the county and city provided to overhaul the place, right? This is just basic maintenance. What's the difference?
Okay, so the Q transformation deal that went through a couple years, I mean, that was its own thing. So let's think of that in a separate category. The money that we're talking about now is for, they call it major capital repairs. It's what the county's obligated to pay for on both the ballpark and the arena, though this money doesn't have anything to do with the ballpark. The county's obligated to pay for these major capital repairs. Recently, it's been things like the ice floor in the hockey arena when it's hockey season, different basic building structures.
How much ice do you buy for $40 million?
Well, that was...
It's the piping. I know for I've attended a few of those meetings, and it's the very non-sexy stuff, obviously. The capital improvements include, the heating, the cooling systems. In roof. Particular, the ice has been on their list for several years. They did the roof, recently got money for that. And the leases, this is the most basic aspect of the lease.
Is this work that's already done that they're looking to pay for, or is it future work that they have to pay for?
So this is money that the Cavs already fronted because the county had yet to give them. So the Cavs fronted for these repairs. These repairs are already done or under construction or already been approved by Gateway, which is basically the lease manager for the county.
So the county owes the Cavs $40 million, and they got to figure out how to pay for it. And one of the ways may be they're going to borrow this and pay interest on that loan to pay back the money they already owe to the Cavs.
Correct. And one thing this doesn't really address is what happens if an unforeseeable major capital repair comes up in 3 years. There's not going to be money for that. This is reimbursing things that have already been done.
Where does the cash come from to repay the loan they would take out to pay the money to the Cavs? Is there already money in the general fund for that, or are they looking to raise taxes?
Well, the money for the repairs to the stadiums is supposed to come from the sin tax that voters renewed in 2014. But the thing is not enough money comes in from the sin tax. I think in 2018, it was about 14 mil came in from the sin tax. What's needed or what the teams say they need as far as major capital repairs for these facilities far outpace the revenues from that tax. So this bond money is kind of an advance.
Can you expect the same kind of request coming from the Indians for tens of millions more for their maintenance?
Well, the Indians were pretty mum in this recent discussion. We have to remember that lease negotiations are coming up there, so maybe they don't want to put their hand out ahead of those negotiations, perhaps. Yeah.
So what you're saying is people in Cuyahoga County need to commit more sins in order to help pay for the stadium repairs, maybe?
We'll have to see.
All right. Well, speaking of sins, after seeing the success of the Cleveland Script signs in various photogenic city spots and the huge number of photos taken at them, Parma wants in. Mary, you wrote up this week this story. What's the deal there?
Yeah, the folks in Parma saw the Destination Cleveland signs that went up across the city ahead of the Republican National Convention in 2016. I'm sure you've seen them. Most of them overlook some beautiful view of downtown. So many photos, so many people have gone out to these signs to take pictures next to the Cleveland signs. A councilman in Parma thought this was great. He runs a charity. He started raising money to give Parma its own sign. The hope is that people will come out to Parma, maybe take a few pictures, eat at some restaurants, you know, go shop at Parma. So it's Parma's new destination.
One of the more interesting pictures I saw this week was a guy on top of the Parma sign surrounded by pink flamingos. Parma is often the butt of jokes. Does it risk embarrassment with this sign where lots of people are going to come out to do those kind of antics?
Yeah, I mean, I think Parma has a reputation, and I think, you know, they understand that sometimes they're laughed at. But no, I think that they're really proud of the sign. They really believe that this is going to attract some folks to come out to Parma to check it out. It's right by the splash pad at Anthony Zelinsky Park, if you're interested. The hope is it'll spur some economic development. So it's there if you want to take a picture next to it.
All right. After a break, we'll talk about the move to provide lawyers to people in poverty who face eviction. It's This Week in the CLE.
If you want to read what Ohio's decision makers read, subscribe to Capital Letter, your first read of the morning newsletter from Cleveland.com. It's packed with tightly written summaries of everything you need to be up to date on the state's political scene. Subscribe at Cleveland.com/newsletters.
We're back on This Week in the CLE. I'm Chris Quinn with Mark Namick, and in this segment, politics editor Jane Cahoon, special projects editor Laura Johnston, and City Hall reporter Bob Higgs. Jane, Laura, and Bob, you're keeping busy this week. Any expectation that the summer doldrums will slow down the flow of news in your areas?
Not this summer.
Not a bit.
Not a chance. Right.
This week, a team from Legal Aid Society of Cleveland and Cleveland City Council President Kevin Kelly visited us to talk about how close we are to providing lawyers for people who are in poverty and facing eviction. The Legal Aid team reiterated how devastating eviction is for people in poverty because of how it interrupts school for kids, depletes their limited funds, and throws up all sorts of hurdles for them for emerging from poverty. Hazel Remish, a legal aid attorney immersed in the project, explained some of what they have learned about Cleveland evictions. First, she told us how many people who get evicted have lawyers in Cleveland.
What does the landscape look like? There's 9,000 evictions that are filed every year in the city of Cleveland alone, about 20,000 countywide. Only 1% to 2% of the tenants who are going into court are represented by an attorney, whereas 75% of landlords are showing up to court with a lawyer by their side.
Then she told us a bit about who gets evicted.
77% of them were African-American women. 60% of the households have children, with the two children on average. We also learned that about 38% of the people we surveyed were actually working full-time at the time of the eviction. And the median monthly income was about $1,200 a month.
Finally, she told us what happened in New York when lawyers were provided to people being evicted.
So New York has now been, they're phasing their implementation in over 5 years. At the end of their first year, they've seen that 84% of the households who went into eviction court with a lawyer by their side avoided displacement.
With all of that, Council President Kelly explained that the argument for providing lawyers to those facing eviction has been made, and he's now trying to figure out how to pay for it.
For reasons that have been stated, that the, you know, kind of like the moral case has been made, and that argument, that's over with. And it's a question of how do we get to the end? And that is a math problem that's not as simple as, you know, number of cases times cost equals what the city's on the hook for. It's a matter of how do we put together, and anything we do in government, how do you put together something that's going to be sustainable, that doesn't, you know, if it runs off the rails, it will be not good for future councils and mayors. And tenants and our housing community. So we're looking at different things like, well, right now legal aid provides services for up to 200% of federal poverty guidelines. Maybe we can't go that high to start. You know, maybe we're looking at 150, maybe we're looking at 100. Maybe we're looking at families with children. Maybe we're looking, so we're trying to plug in different formulas to come up with, you know, what is that number that is something that is sustainable. And, you know, spoiler alert, it is going to start limited.
So, Bob, when is Kelly aiming to have the legislation ready?
I think he'd like to have something over the summer. Council goes on recess June 3rd, but they'll have a couple of big summer meetings. But it's going to take a little while to pull it together because he's got to figure out how to pay for it. That could push it into early fall, but he wants to get at this pretty quickly.
He was visibly uncomfortable during our discussion when people brought up cost. Do you think that's because he has to navigate a very challenging political landscape to make this happen and worries that early talk about cost will just make it harder?
I think that's a big part of it because we're talking about millions of dollars here potentially. And that's a hard sell to some members of council and also to some parts of the community. You've got people out there who'll say, oh, they just paid their rent, they wouldn't be in this fix. But it's not that simple. That's the moral thing. But finding a way to pay for it is tricky because it is a lot of money.
We learned a lot about the challenges for affordable housing and eviction through the project that we did on poverty called A Greater Cleveland, something Mark was involved in. And the need to help people who are facing eviction. We even had the guy who wrote the book about eviction come to town and give a speech at Playhouse Square about these challenges. How important do you think this would be, Mark, to changing the landscape?
It'll make a huge difference on two levels. One is, first, let's address that they're not looking to get people out of paying rent. What they found is that people get taken advantage of without a lawyer, so things become worse. A landlord will not only go for the back rent, but then will hit them for damages, you know, in the apartment, so that it becomes a secondary cost and hit on them. And often when they are represented by a lawyer, when the tenant is, you realize that, okay, hey, that tenant has been complaining for months about the leaky ceiling, so you can't charge them for it. That's something that was on the landlord. They just want to, you know, make it a little more balanced. And when there is a lawyer involved, this is the other big impact, they often find that a little negotiation can resolve the situation for both sides. Maybe they can figure out a way to delay the payment. If there's a promise made or some money is given up front, then the landlord says, okay, you can stay. I'll get my money. I don't have to go through the cost of re-renting. And things move forward. And that's the goal. The goal is not to get them out of paying what they owe. It is to make sure that they're not taking advantage of for being poor.
Well, those numbers from Hazel were astounding. I mean, to go from winning a couple of percent of the time to well over more than half the time. The other thing that they all talked about is once the landlord knows they might be up against somebody with a lawyer, they're much less likely to seek eviction because they know that the units are not really up to speed. And once there's a lawyer from the tenant saying, hey, there was no water for a month, what gives, that they get in trouble with the housing court?
This whole study, we've been following it for a couple of years with the Legal Aid Society, really is about much bigger system too, right? They want to get at if a landlord has a bad roof, does this trigger an inspection? Obviously, that's the stick that scares them. By coming into that court, then someone may go check. There's been efforts by Legal Aid Society and others to get a registry of landlords on the books, which is now there, and they have to begin to catalog everybody that's every property that's a renter, rentable property, and that eventually things will be better, you know. Better oversight and all that stuff with it. So there's a lot to this program.
All right, let's stick with Kevin Kelly for a minute. Bob, we thought all of our questions and browbeating had finally persuaded Kelly to hold some oversight hearings about several pressing issues. He took the necessary steps of scheduling them, and then he canceled them. Now we won't see this oversight at least until the end of summer, and really, summer hasn't even begun yet. What are the two issues we're talking about?
One of them has to do with a deal that would have bought the building at 1801 Superior, the former Plain Dealer publishing.
Where we record this podcast.
And they were extremely excited, by they, I mean the Mayor Jackson's administration, about buying this building and making it police headquarters. They said it fit everything they needed. And you could see the chief of police, who's usually relatively reserved, was smiling ear to ear when he was talking about it. And all of a sudden that deal fell through. And they've never gotten a good explanation from the administration as to just what happened. Everybody sort of heard things through the grapevine. And now I think there's enough frustration out there that between our goading of the council president and the members, they want to bring in the administration and ask them what happened.
But that deal formally collapsed last October.
Right. It's been months.
We are way beyond the time where you would think you'd get these answers. And now we're probably not going to get them until it's almost a full year later. Why?
They had the hearing scheduled finally, and then they had scheduling issues come up with getting the people they need to bring in. They'll need to bring in the safety director. They'll need to bring in the chief of police. They'll need to bring in some projects people from the administration, and the schedules didn't mesh. So they end up scratching it all of a sudden. But you're right. It's probably after Labor Day now.
So did the administration thwart it by just saying, yeah, we're not sending our people over?
Nobody's saying that. It's certainly something you wonder about because they've been, in the meantime, trying to deal with the need for a new police headquarters on the side. And occasionally you'll hear them mention that they're looking at other possibilities.
And what's the other issue that they were supposed to do the oversight on?
The other generally involves airport safety. And this is another one that Cleveland.com has been pushing them on because the administration has been very tight-lipped about giving complete answers about three different episodes at the airport. One involves two members of the administration bypassing security. One of them involves a guy who was completely inebriated, plowing through a gate and driving across the runways and out the other side of the airport.
Without anybody noticing.
Without anybody noticing for almost 3 hours. And then the third involved the malware that got into the system and took down message boards and their email system for the better part of a week. And in each case, they have been less than forthcoming. And there's some frustration in city council, particularly with the one last October that involved the administration. Members of council have never been fully briefed on that either. And there's a certain amount of, we have oversight on the airport. We need you to come and tell us what happened. And they finally got to a point where they were going to call that one in too. And then I think it got backed up with other things coming up for the June 3rd meeting, the last meeting before recess, and ended up getting pushed aside.
And maybe it's time to do a piece that says, here are all the unanswered questions we still have on these two issues, and we won't have them now for many months. While city council business seems to be blocked up, things are flowing on the Cuyahoga River. Laura, you reported this week on something that might break the stalemate that has developed between people who want to park their boats in the flats and the people who want to keep the channel clear for shipping. What happened, and then what's the future?
So this was a temporary conditional waiver from the Coast Guard for Memorial Day weekend. The issue, there is allowed some boat docking in the flats, but the spot we're talking about is from the Alley Cat north onto the Norfolk Southern Bridge, which is a railroad bridge that's usually down, and boaters refer to it as the Iron Curtain of the Cuyahoga River. So it plays a big role in boats kind of lining up to get in or out of the river or the lake. So this week, they allowed docking in that one stretch of the safety zone, and then they were told if there's a freighter coming through and they give notification, they have a half hour to move. And so they tried it on Memorial Day. We have a video from our live bridge cam at the Music Box Supper Club. And they got notification. They moved out. It worked. And then the folks from FASTAR, which is a nonprofit education and marine safety group, they moved them all back in. So it was a success. They're meeting again to see if they can do it again this summer. And it would allow boaters to dock where they want to dock, but protect the boats and the people from freighters.
That costs some money, I presume. Who's paying for this?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are a lot of safety issues going on in the river this year, as we've talked about before, things like the signs, digital signs going up, River Ambassador Program. And it's kind of been all of these groups coming together and doing it and then figuring it out later who's going to be in charge, because they just want to get it rather than like studying it for a while and then moving. They want this to work. So I think there's a lot of groups. We have a Cuyahoga River Safety Task Force meeting coming up next week. I'm sure that will be a big part of it.
In other news on the waterfront, you reported people should not swim in Lake Erie this week. Why not?
Well, remember that really big rain on Tuesday night? So a really big pipe at Edgewater Beach, which is a combined sewer overflow pipe, went off. That's the phrasing they use at the Northeast Ohio Sewer District. 142,000 gallons of raw sewage and water combined and went out into the beach, which created obviously some poor water conditions. So they said, stay out of the water. There's sewage in it. This doesn't happen very often. Last time it happened was August during the recreation system. But it is bad news when you have sewage in your beach.
So they canceled the first Edgewater Live this week, saying that it was due to the expected storms. But might it have been because of the stench of sewage?
I have not been there to smell it right now. But if there were, that would be a problem. Thousands of people go down there every Thursday night for 10 weeks in the summer. And it's a big celebration of summer. So they postponed it. They're going to hopefully come up with a new date. But yeah, that is kind of sad that we lost our kickoff to summer.
Yeah. What you see, and I've been using the beach for decades as a windsurfer. Some I've been down there after storms, unfortunately. And what you're getting is what washes up on the beach is the problem, because people still incorrectly discharge personal hygiene products and things in the sewer. And when that makes its way to the lake, then it gets washed back up. That's why you see that there. That isn't somebody that left those items that came through that overflow. The good news here is hopefully someday soon we will stop talking about this issue, because we have been spending millions and millions of dollars to correct the problem, essentially make separate pipes that are big enough to hold it. It's part of a 25-year, $3 billion plus issue that we hope will get there. And we'll say we are paying for it. About 35% of your sewer bill is going solely to pay off the costs of building these bigger pipes and separate pipes.
And that's Project Clean Lake, which you see growing up around town. There's a big project at University Circle right now. They finished the one down by the river. And there's 122 combined sewer overflow points in the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District territory. Unfortunately, even after the $3 billion is spent, we're not going to eliminate every overflow every time. We're just going to get down to a really minuscule number. But Mark tells me that the one at Edgewater will be, not have to worry about our beach anymore.
That's right next to the beach.
Right.
If that one isn't fixed, then this project is a failure. I mean, let's eliminate the one next to the swimmers.
We talked earlier about the county's fumbling of cash payments. We have another story that deals with cash handling. A movement is afoot to get the U.S. Postal Service in Cleveland to set up banking services, especially for people of limited means. Jane, you edited Sabrina Eaton's piece on this. How would the post office operate like a bank?
Well, actually, once upon a time, the post office did offer savings accounts from 1911 to 1967. So there's an Inspector General's report that says the post office is equipped to do this, to offer savings accounts, electronic fund transfers, even personal loans, which they believe, with the tens of thousands of locations of post offices, that they could fill a financial need in urban areas and rural areas where banks do not have branches.
Would this obviate the need for the check cashing places and the other forms of banking that people in poverty are forced to contend with at high interest rates? And
yes, they very much hope that this would be an alternative to the payday loan, which, as you know, can be expensive for people. They charge exorbitant rates, even though we do have new regulations. But they do think that, yes, this would provide an alternative. So.
Why Cleveland?
Well, I think they are just mobilizing. The Postal Workers Union, Marcy Kaptur, the congresswoman who represents part of Cleveland, and some Cleveland officials and some Brook Park officials, they are mobilizing, and they've got a letter or a petition to be presented to the Postal Service saying, let's do this.
All right. The eternal battle over how to draw Ohio's congressional districts is in a temporary hold. We've talked a good bit about the federal lawsuit seeking to redraw the lines for the 2020 elections. A judge ordered the redrawing. The state appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which told Ohio to stop in its tracks. What's the deal there?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court granted a stay that was requested by the state. The state said, no, this would cause too much chaos, and the court didn't really elaborate on its reasons for ruling, but or for granting the stay, but the big thing is that there are cases in North Carolina and Maryland that the court is going to issue a ruling on by the end of June, other gerrymandering cases. And presumably, the Supreme Court already knows what that ruling's going to say, so you know, it's hard to read between the lines. Does their granting of this stay mean that they're going to throw out the challenges in the other states, or does it mean they're about to come out with some specific guidelines about, you know, a blueprint for drawing fair maps?
And you really can't read into what they did for that.
The Supreme Court? No, you cannot read into that.
All right. A key traffic release valve in Cleveland closed this week, the part of I-490 between I-77 and East 55th Street. The first rush hour of the closure was Thursday morning. Jane, you worked with Rich Exner to set up coverage of this. What did we see?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to Rich because apparently he thoroughly informed our readers about this, and they all found their alternate routes, and things went pretty smoothly this morning. He and Hannah Drown were monitoring the situation, and people found the detours. There was a little bit of a bottleneck maybe around Harvard, a little south of 490 and 77, but we didn't see anything that was unusual for a rush hour.
And we didn't hear people complaining about longer commutes or anything?
Not so far, no.
That's pretty good. Mark, one local mayor wants to see more traffic in her town. You went deep this week on efforts by the Maple Heights mayor to bring change. What did you learn?
That Maple Heights is still a struggling inner ring suburb, but the new mayor, new as in end of her first term, is trying to be optimistic in the face of, you know, declining property values, the loss of tax revenue, which is very common to inner ring suburbs. This is a suburb that has been under state fiscal control for several years because they failed to make some bond payments in 2015. Mayor Annette Blackwell, who's the first African-American mayor in 100-year history of that city, says she's confident they'll get out from under that this year. But what drew me to this suburb was an observation made by a reader who contacted us and said, you know, this sit-down waiter or waitress bring you a menu, restaurants are just gone. It's all fast food or maybe a locally owned one where you could sit and eat, but there's really that idea of a diner where you could slide into a booth, get a greeting, maybe see some friends across the aisle at a table, isn't there. And that really represents this vision that the new mayor, or mayor's up for re-election now, that she wants to bring back to the city. She has to go elsewhere to have a breakfast.
What struck me is she grew up in East Cleveland, and she's worried about her city now becoming
East Cleveland. She grew up right actually on the Cleveland side, but you know, played and saw life in East Cleveland and felt not enough was done to guide that city through its tough times. And she made this incredible observation that I hadn't heard, that there's this perception among residents, and they use this term that they're becoming the next EC2, East Cleveland 2. And she really is troubled by that. There were moments when we hung out that you can see that it maybe is overwhelming of a problem, but she's trying. She's trying to change the zoning codes there so that they can stop the proliferation of daycare centers, hair braiding shops, nail salons, which are kind of like they just fill in like quicksand in these, you know, these little commercial districts. And her point is there's not a lot of income and economic development that comes from such places. And so we've got to have a better system in place. And this was just a revisiting of this. And I think this is the same. This is a larger story that's going on in a lot of inner rings.
Part of the issue there is also the limited housing stock. Much of the housing is on the small side compared to what people seek today.
Well, look, part of flight out of any of those inner ring suburbs is people look for better houses and more land. So they certainly have suffered that. This mayor got very excited to tell me about a recent house transfer where the house sold for $126,000. So, like, they thought there's a slight uptick. This was a big deal, and So they're trying.
I mean, her expectations or her dreams aren't even that like outrageous, right? She just wants a Starbucks. She's like, I'll settle for a Starbucks. And so you've seen all of this, you know, all of that kind of retail like go out and out now with the new Pinecrest, and you just, there's got to be some infill.
Well, you know, you got to have the dollars, right? The triple that people want is a Starbucks, a Verizon store, and like a Target. And when you have that in community, that means those companies say the dollars are there, right? Mm-hmm. That's not very common in some of these inner ring suburbs. So that may be too much of a stretch, but, you know, look, they're getting some things like a new KFC, but, you know, she really wants that even if it's locally owned, just come in. And it's a great thing to shoot for, and you take it for granted, because I never thought about it, that there isn't a place like that for mm-hmm. her to go eat.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, an East Side Guide for West Siders and the West Side Guide for East Siders. It's This Week in the CLE.
You've been reading the writers at Cleveland.com for years, and now you can engage with them on a more personal level through Project Text. For a small monthly fee, you can receive text messages from the likes of Mary Kay Cabot, Paul Hoynes, Mark Namick, Troy Smith, and many others in our newsroom. Project Text gives you a cost-effective way to support the journalism upon which you rely. Check it out at cleveland.com/projecttext.
You're listening to This Week in the CLE. I'm Chris Quinn with Mark Namick, Laura Johnston, and in this segment, Life and Culture editor Mike Norman and our beer and wine expert, Mark Bona. Welcome all.
Good to be here.
Laura, you oversaw a different kind of project that published this week, tapping into the expertise of East Siders and West Siders to put together the perfect day for their friends across the river. You called it the Guide to the Other Side. So let's start with the West Side, since you live there. I'm from the East Side. What's the ideal day for me to get to know your side of the river?
So I just want to point out that I had lived 9 years on the East Side and 3 years on the West Side. And I've lived on the South Side. So I feel like I'm uniquely able to see all sides of Cleveland here. So for the West Side, we had a number of things you might know, like the West Side Market, and fun other things that are a little quirkier. Like we did workouts and breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There was a lot of food and activities on each side. So we talked about the Fort Hill Stairs of the Rocky River Reservation as a great place to get a workout on. Obviously, there are metro parks on both sides of the river. We had Gordon Square as a great place to shop around. We had the beaches. I don't think you can argue that the West Side beaches are better at Edgewater and Huntington. And landmarks, Crocker Park made our list just for regular shopping. The Christmas Story House is they can't miss if you've never been there, which you got to see once in your life. The Memphis Kitty Park if you've got kids. And just a whole day to see what the other side has to offer.
So when you're using Crocker Park as a highlight, it's clear that the right side is the east side.
Oh, Pinecrest was on the east side, too.
So let's talk about what you can do as an ideal day on the right side of town, the east side.
So we actually had two separate guides for the east side, one that included the University Circle and one without. And my viewpoint on that is most West Siders have been to University Circle museums at some point in their lives, even if it was for a field trip. So I wanted to give you some other stuff to do, like the Maltz Museum in Beechwood, and pockets like Shaker Square and Chagrin Falls for an afternoon of just walking around, looking at the waterfalls, browsing. We do have Euclid Beach on there. Shaker Rocks, which is a new rock climbing place in Shaker Heights, is on there. Yeah, it's Tommy's, a lot of institutions. I feel like the East Side has these really well-known places that have existed for a long time, like Corky and Lenny's, that people can just, they've heard of, should just cross the bridge and get to the other side.
All right, so this stuff is on Cleveland.com, and clearly based on her description, the much more interesting part of this is the East Side. A lot of this involves eating and drinking, and Mike, your team published a side of the river agnostic guide to 50 places to eat and drink in the region. It's something your team does each year. What are the highlights?
Well, you know, we started this years ago with the critics picking the dishes and the drinks to eat that there were their favorites. And we decided about 5 years ago that it would be much more interesting if we crowdsourced this with Cleveland foodies and other notables and celebrities. Gives us a lot of diversity of opinion and also some surprises that you don't normally get from just critics. So it's just a really great list every year. This year, we had everybody from Michael Simon and Channing Frye picking dishes and or drinks to foodies like owners of La Plaza Supermarket and associate curator of European art at the Cleveland Museum of Art. So, you know, Michael Simon is picking the sausage sandwich at Frank's Bratwurst at the West Side Market. Channing Frye, who Mark talked to, picked the grilled salmon at Ginkgo. You get a lot of great diversity.
Yeah, I would agree. And Laura said it best earlier. We were talking, and she really picked up on the fact that pasta, this list is very pasta heavy.
Pasta and meat.
And that's okay. That's a good thing. And I had fun. I like the fact, I think this list has evolved and gotten a lot better in the last few years because the diverse group of people is leading to a diverse group of selections. Like Mike said, Channing Frye, I talked to him. I did not realize until right before he retired how much of a foodie he is. He really, really geeks out on Dante, loved Ginkgo, loved a lot of selections there. Simon could choose anyone or anything, and he travels all over the country, and he loves his hometown, and he chooses a sausage sandwich at the West Side Market, a specific stand at the West Side Market at Frank's. And many others. And I thought, you know, the diversity of this list just keeps getting better and better every year.
I mean, I've been to Platform many, many times, and maybe I just didn't notice it on the menu, but I didn't realize they had a beer slushy, which Corey Corco of the Cleveland Museum of Art pointed out. So I'm going to have to try that. That just seems intensely interesting to me to have a beer slushy. Also, the manager of La Plaza Supermarket, which is a great taco place on the West Side, actually picked a Cuban sandwich at Best Damn Tacos, a competitor down the road. So I'm going to have to try that out too.
How much of this list changes every year?
I think quite a bit. I really do. I mean, you see, maybe you see some of the same places stay in this year to year, but you see a lot of different dishes. I'm amazed at how many of these places I'm very, very familiar with, but the dishes I wasn't. I go in and when you go into a restaurant, I mean, there's a chance that you and your friend are going to order two different things. And it was amazing how many different dishes this list solicits every year.
I really think that's why this list is so popular, because it's not about a restaurant, it's about the dish. So it's entrees, appetizers, desserts, drinks. There were not as many drinks this year as there have been in the past. Not sure why, beer slushies aside. But you get everything from like sautéed Brussels sprouts at Felice, which, you know, who knew, to like the lamb pastrami at Vault. It's just a great variety and diversity of food. Lots of good desserts on here too. Some vanilla ice cream with hot caramel sauce at Mitchell's, tiramisu at Prestige Bakery. A good selection.
It's got 50 things to eat and drink.
In Greater Cleveland.
Check it out on cleveland.com. That'll do it for this episode of This Week in the CLE. Thanks to Mark Namick, Mary Kilpatrick, Evan McDonald, Courtney Astafi, Bob Higgs, Jane Cahoon, Laura Johnston, Mike Norman, and Mike Bona. Check in every Thursday night or Friday morning for the latest episode. I'm Chris Quinn, and you've been listening to This Week in the CLE.